Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our first episode to air on Radio Free Hillsdale. Our guest is Lou Guernsey, an ex-prisoner of war who came home and married his sweetheart. They're going to celebrate their 71st wedding anniversary in September. We'll hear about their post-war reunion in a bit. But you can catch Lou playing his banjo at the Hillsdale County Fairgrounds in August. He's there every year. I'll give you the exact dates before we're done. Shot down on his 32nd mission as a B-26 tail gunner in March of 1945, he spent the rest of the war as a prisoner. He's shared some pretty unique experiences, but perhaps none more unique than this one.
The Germans used to take the fur collars off our flying suits, mm-hmm. or, you know, as jackets. They were a mouton fur, artificial, you know, made.
Synthetic fur.
But anyway, yeah. I don't know why they took them, but they had a whole lot of them. So some of the guys got them, and they built an outhouse, and they lined that outhouse with them fur collars, inside and out, the door, the ceiling, the floor, the seat. And I'm going to tell you, I use a fur-lined outhouse. Now, you've heard about them, but I actually used one.
In a prisoner of war camp,
like, yeah.
Of all places.
Yeah. These guys, I tell you, they just had to do something. They'd been boxed up so long. The Russians brought in 150 cows, and they were Holstein cows, beautiful cows, for us to eat. So there's guys in there that had done everything, you know. So some of them went down and started butchering these cows. And I grabbed a pitcher that we had for water, and I told the guys, I said, I'm going down and get some milk. Somebody come on and hold these cows. Well, so a couple of guys went there, and they'd hold the cows, and I'd milk them. Because I'd been on a farm, I knew how to milk cows. But I went back with this beautiful milk. Some of the guys wouldn't drink it because it wasn't pasteurized. I drank it. It was great. Then was in the camp about 2 weeks, maybe 2.5 weeks after the Russians came, before the Americans brought in airplanes to fly us out. The Russians wanted to march us back into Russia. No way. Oh, and one other thing. Hitler, before he killed himself, gave an order to the prison camps to shoot all the American and English airmen.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody did. Jesus, wouldn't that have been horrible?
Mm. We wouldn't be talking right now, that's for
sure.
No,
well, just think of the slaughter it would have been. You know,
thousands and thousands.
They knew better.
Well,
Hitler, he went out of his rocker anyway at the end. And
you mentioned what the Russians wanted to do with you, and what I've understood from other prisoners who were at Stalag Luft I is that the reason the Russians didn't was because a courageous ace of a P-47 pilot, Colonel Hub Zemke, negotiated a different outcome, right?
That's right. Zemke, he wouldn't let him take us away. But you know, the Russians, the average Russian that I saw, he was just like us, you know. He wanted to get the war over and go home.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no problem with the Russians. I went into town, walked around, seen them. And all their women, they all had a great big pistol on their rump, so you didn't bother none of the Russian girls. And I don't think the Russian men would like it if you had them. But the Russians hated the Germans because they'd killed so many Russians.
Sure. You know, I want to get to what it felt like to be free again, but before we go there, I know you weren't in the POW camp for as long as some of those other fellas that you were there with. I guess you were there not quite 2 months, but what was the biggest challenge for you? What was the hardest thing to deal with? And did you have some nights where, you know, you really felt desperate or hopeless?
No. The biggest thing to deal with was the lack of food. There was always that constant hunger. And that was the big thing. To me, I knew the war was about over. And once I got in, well, I felt kind of secure in the prison camp. It was getting there that was bad. One night they put me in a room that was lined with hardware cloth. It was a post office. And I think the whole people come in there, the whole town, and looked at me, you know, and lot of them said things to me that I didn't know what they were saying because they were talking in German, but it wasn't nice. They were the ones that was giving you the problems. I remember one night we stopped outside of a beer joint, a beer garden, pub or whatever you want to call them over there, and a bunch of German soldiers was in there. You could hear the music going on in there and everything and the laughter and the camaraderie they were having. Some of them come out and it was bad that they called us everything, you know. There was one soldier there that had a suit on. Oh, it was pressed. And he was a good-looking guy, don't get me wrong. And he probably was a good soldier, but he walked up and down laughing at us, you know, and he was telling us how worthless we was and stuff like that. And I thought to myself, one of these days a Russian's going to get to you, and then what are you going to holler and laugh about? He stuck out in my mind. And often wondered, I'll bet he didn't survive because he was one of them kind, you know, that you would shoot in a minute.
You could see it coming.
Yeah. If he wasn't a prisoner, you know, of course you didn't shoot prisoners, but at least we didn't, I guess.
What was the moment for you where you really felt your freedom again, where you realized you were no longer a prisoner?
When we got up in the morning and we looked out and there was Americans in the gun towers. They had a white band on their left arm. The Germans had gone. That's when we knew we were safe. Now, we hadn't thought too much about the Russians, you know. We wondered about them a little bit, but we knew that was the time. Then this Russian colonel, they were going to leave the fences up until they flew us out, but this Russian colonel said, no. He said, take the fences down, go to town, and take what you want. The guys, some of them come back with automobiles, and I knew a guy by the name of Bill Bensinger. He was from Ionia here. He was in that prison camp. He come back with a set of black horses on a hearse riding around. They made him take them back. Yeah. They belonged to the Burgermeister.
I suppose, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and I understand that the journey after that, and a little plane ride after you were liberated was just as hair-raising for you as anything leading up to it.
Oh, yeah. We were flown up to Camp Lucky Strike.
Right.
Now, they had named these camps after cigarettes. So, and here come a B-26, and it buzzed the camp. And I looked at the tail markings, and that was from my outfit. And I thought, gee, I got to see who that is. Well, when it landed and I walked up to the airplane, here come my original co-pilot. Mm. Brandy was his name. He said, well, come on. He says, we'll fly you back to Venlo. He says, we moved to Venlo. He says, we'll fly back there. And I said, I haven't got a pass. I can't go. Well, he went in and got me a 3-day pass. So we got in the airplane and we started to fly back and we hit the worst storm that I'd ever seen. And I thought, man, here we are up in raining, just pelting. And he had to look down, and he seen a runway down there. And he went down through the clouds, and he landed that airplane. And when, I mean, in full blast. And he hit the brakes, and the brakes were squealing, and the airplane was shuddering. And we were coming toward the end of the runway, and I thought, yeah, here I am. I survived the war. I went to prison camp. I'm going to get killed in this airplane. And peacetime, you know, but it stopped. And we got out, and we found out that we was at a mosquito outfit, the English mosquitoes.
Right, the bombers.
Well, yeah. We stayed there overnight, and the next morning it was nice. We took off and went back to the outfit and landed. And I seen all of my buddies.
You had a girl to get home to and try to talk her into marrying you if she would still have you. How did that all work out?
No, I didn't have to talk to her very hard. She was ready to get married, I think.
What was that reunion like?
I called my stepmother and said, no, I'm going to be in Grand Rapids at a certain time in the morning, coming in on a train. I says, come over and pick me up. Now, that's about 35 miles from Ionia. So they come over and pick me up. Now, there was my sister and my stepmother and my wife, my girlfriend. That was a great reunion. Oh, that was great. It was just a few days before that they found out that I was alive.
Yeah, they had not even known. They received a telegram saying you were missing, where it refers to you in the past tense as if you're no longer living. And I imagine that you heard some stories about the rejoicing that occurred there when they found out you were alive.
The Army gave to my stepmother the addresses of the mothers of the other crew members. And now there were six of them. And these women all wrote to each other to see if anybody'd heard anything and stuff like that. And they didn't know what was going on. Now, Sherry, who was our co-pilot, I mean the bombardier, his wife had a baby while he was overseas, and he never seen that one. That makes you sad, you know. His wife writes and says, well, I don't know what happened to John. I pray for him and everything, and here he's dead. Like, we three gunners got out, and the three officers up in front of the airplane. Yeah, the aircraft, the shells broke up in front of the airplane. One went right through the main right gas tank. And when I bailed out, there was gas pouring out of that. It's a wonder that didn't explode. I don't know why that shell, they said, went up ahead over the airplane and exploded above. But when it went through that wing, it's a wonder it didn't touch off that gasoline. The left engine was feathered. That means it was stopped, and they feathered the props so that they don't drag. And then Sherry and Turner were dead up there, so there must have been one exploded right near the cockpit. And Arnold, the pilot, he was mortally wounded, and he knew that, so he gave us orders to bail out. He didn't say, come up here and help me fly the airplane. He didn't say, come up and give me a hand. He said, bail out, and when they tell you to bail out, you go. You do what you're told.
And you didn't understand that all at the time, but
no,
now that
you
do.
No, not at the time, but I found it out later on.
And I'll tell you, it's choking me up a little bit just listening to you explain it that way, and I'm sure our listeners are experiencing the same thing, but it occurs to me that that's probably as fine an example of courage and selflessness that you've encountered.
Well, when we went out, I looked up in front, but there was nothing moving up there. You could see up through the airplane as far as you could see, you know, and there was nothing up there. We could see into the cockpit, but I could not see the pilot or the co-pilot. I seen between them, and I could see nothing up there, you know, so we got out. We was told to. And everybody knew that these airplanes, you know, airplanes were made to kill people. And they would kill Germans, they would kill Americans, they would kill Frenchmen, English, they killed anybody. I've seen a lot of guys get killed in airplanes, and it wasn't good.
So when you think back on that now, and you see the life you've been able to live, that you got back, you married your sweetheart, the kids, the grandkids, the banjo, everything that you've experienced in life, and you realize that your pilot paid that price for you. It created that opportunity for you by allowing himself to die in that situation. What do you do with that? How grateful does that make you? Am I overstating it, or do you feel a real sense of gratitude?
No. The pilot kept that airplane flying level. He could have let it do anything, but he kept it flying level, and he crash-landed it. Then he died on the way to the hospital, so he was still alive. I think about him, and I've often thought, did I do wrong because we didn't try to get a medal for him, for his parents, for him? Mm. No, I wrote to his parents and explained it all to them, and they thanked me. Yeah, it still bothers me because he's buried down in Columbus, Ohio. And I was wondering if maybe someday I shouldn't take a ride down there and take him some flowers. Another thing that I've seen was strange over there. You ever heard about that cathedral in Koblenz?
In Cologne.
Or Cologne, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen that from the air. We flew by it one day, you know, and the anti-aircraft was much anti-aircraft around that thing. But there's another instance. I think God put a bubble around that cathedral. It never got damaged. It got some peck marks on it and stuff like that. But
well, and wasn't the bridge adjacent to it completely destroyed?
Yeah. Yes, everything was destroyed around it. I don't know how to explain it. It's like taking a house and putting it out in the middle of a field, and there's a house sitting there, and everything's flat around it. You could see that cathedral for miles, and Cologne was gone, but that cathedral sat there, and it was beautiful, and it made you feel good to know that it hadn't been damaged to a point to where it collapsed and stuff. Now, I was in some cathedrals, some big churches. We landed up at Toul one time because we were running out of gas. We landed at a fighter strip, and I went into town in Toul, and I went into a big church there that was half destroyed. Beautiful church. Great big church, you know, and made out of stone. The architecture was marvelous. all destroyed. It hurts you to see things like that. I'll tell you something. God has blessed me, has blessed my wife and my family, and I totally believe that. And I've been humble ever since to that fact that we got out of that airplane alive.
Well, I don't think anyone listening today would argue or would fail to understand why you feel that way. And it's a powerful story that you've shared with us. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. Thank you very much for serving our country. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners today?
We was kids. I was 20 years old when all that was going on. And we did what we had to do, and if we had to do it, and we did. And that makes me proud to think of the men that I knew that stood up to the fact and beat the Germans. They were all kids, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, no, there's nothing more I want to say except God bless all the people listening, and I hope they have a good time.
That's Lou Guernsey, now 91 years old, of Ionia, Michigan. Look for him August 12th and 13th at the Hillsdale County Fairgrounds when he plays his banjo during the Fiddlers Convention and Traditional Music Festival. And check out his photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.